Okay, good. The topic for tonight is Nili, Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, the spy ring. So we got up last time to World War I, 1914, in Eretz Yisrael, and in the Zionist movement in Chutz La'aretz and the diaspora. And I left off last time with a comment that in an international conflict, you're going to have Jews who live on both sides of the aisle. Jews who live in Germany, Austria, okay, Ottoman Empire, and Jews who live in Russia, England, France, and then later the United States, on the other side of this war. And how can a movement that is trying to secure the cooperation of a certain ethnic religious group, the Jews, the world over, be able to function when the world is at war? Well, the answer is you go to a neutral country, and you set up shop in some neutral country in Scandinavia. All right, that's the best solution to the problem. But it doesn't really work. Why doesn't it work? Because that's not where the action is. The action is in the capital of the side that's going to win, and not the side that's going to lose, or the neutral actors, which are marginal to the world affairs. So you will have German Zionists in Berlin who are still doing Zionist work, but also rooting for a German victory, and you'll have Zionists in London, or for that matter Paris, who are doing Zionist work and rooting for a British victory. World War I. Yeah. You had chaplains on both sides, Jewish chaplains, that's right. You have Jews fighting on both sides, and dying on both sides, and killing each other, and saying Shema Yisrael together. Trench warfare, yeah.
Where somebody said Kaddish, and on the other side, somebody said Amen.
Right, yeah, it's true. So, from a Jewish point of view, this war was a major opportunity. Because remember, Herzl, and Herzlian Zionism, was all about securing a public charter for the Jewish people somewhere in the world, and hopefully in the land of Israel. But the Ottoman Empire was not cooperative, and although the Yishuv was being built up to an extent in the first and second Aliyot, still, from a diplomatic political point of view, nothing had been achieved. And nothing was going to be achieved until the Ottomans were no longer the masters of Eretz Yisrael. Well, this war is an opportunity to oust them from the country and bring in some other colonial power that will be amenable to the Zionist project. Of course, the question is, which colonial power? We know it ends up being England. At the time, in 1914, that was not a foregone conclusion. It develops over the course of the war that is the best option and the one that ultimately comes to pass. So, in Eretz Yisrael, the Jews are nervous because the Jews, some of them are Ottoman citizens, which has its advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is you can't be deported because you're a citizen, you live there, it's your country. The disadvantage is they could draft you into the army. And who wants to serve for the Turks? People don't really want to. Then what about if you're not an Ottoman citizen? You're a Russian citizen or an Austrian citizen, and you're living in Eretz Yisrael. You made Aliyah from whatever country, but you didn't accept Ottoman citizenship upon arrival. So now, if you're an enemy alien, namely you're a Russian citizen, you could be deported. And thousands of them were deported to Egypt early in the war. Yes, there was an expatriate community of Palestinian Jews in Alexandria and Cairo and in Port Said. Okay? Or, if you don't want to be deported, you could accept Ottomanization and then get drafted into the army. So, either way you slice it, things are not very good for the Jews of Eretz Yisrael when war breaks out. Moreover, the Ottomans need supplies and food, so they requisition crops and materiel, and they impoverish the Yishuv something terrible in 1914 and 1915, aside from the displacement of people who were exiled. So it was Shever Tzizayin Yid in Eretz Yisrael under the Ottomans in the first 2 years of the war. Well, yeah.
I didn't catch
yeah. So some were, Ben Gurion and Ben Svi went to America. Others went to Egypt. Others went to Turkey, went to Constantinople, and spent part of the war in the capital. Okay.
The irony was that the lower east side, you had Feinstein, Ben Gurion and his chevra there.
And Trotsky.
And Trotsky and his chevra
yeah.
there.
And Eliezer and Ben Yehuda too.
In the restaurants, in the cafes, Canal
yeah.
Street, and they all rub shoulders with each other without even realizing their role that they're going to be playing.
That's true. It's true.
Trotsky was there too.
Trotsky, no, not in Israel. Trotsky was in New York. Yeah. So, what happens is that the Jews are nervous about their fate, and they don't want to participate in this war on behalf of Turkey. They might want to participate on behalf of Turkey's enemies, but the danger is if it's too well known that their sympathies lie with the enemy, then they could risk bringing upon themselves even worse privation and devastation. If the Ottoman authorities know that you're rooting for the other team, they'll do even worse things to you. So it's a very delicate balance. You can't be accused of rooting for the wrong side. So the other concern is that the Ottomans are not Europeans. They're Asiatic. And because they're not European in the enlightened European sense of the word, they could be guilty of war crimes and commit genocide. That the Turks have been killing the Armenians for years, and now during the war they're committing an out-and-out genocide. And people are aware of this. It's not a secret. The Jews from Eretz Yisrael, including one we'll discuss this evening, Sarah Aronson, saw it with her own eyes. And the concern is, if the Armenians are inconvenient for the Turks and they get killed, then Jews could also be inconvenient for the Turks and get killed, not just exiled or made to suffer in poverty. Because there were religious differences, ethnic differences. These, they're in the way. They're the wrong religion, the wrong race, everything.
Armenians
are Orthodox Christian, and the Turks are Muslim. Okay, so this is a concern. In 1915... a spy ring develops, led by the Aronson family of Zichron Yaakov. And now we have to go back in time. The Aronson family. Ephraim Fischel and Malka Aronson were part of that group that moved from Romania in 1882 in the first Aliyah, the very beginning of the first Aliyah, and founded Zichron Yaakov. Okay, they were religious Jews, and Zichron Yaakov was basically a religious town. But a town of people who were going to till the soil and transform themselves into the new Jew and wanted to build up the yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael. The town was under the auspices of Baron Rothschild because, as was the style of the time, most of these yeshuvim could not function without his patronage. Aaron Aronson came as a six-year-old. He was born in 1876, so in 1882 he's 6 years old. He's 6 years old. He's the oldest child in the family. And he grows up in Zichron Yaakov. When he's a teenager, in his late teenage years, he is sent to France to learn agronomy and geology and botany. And he excels in his studies. The baron brings him back. The halacha was back then, the baron would pay for your education, and he'd give you a little bit of spending money, but not too much spending money, so you shouldn't enjoy Paris a little too much. And you were not allowed to get a diploma. You were sent home a year before you graduated. Why? Because if you got a diploma, what could happen? You could go anywhere in the world. But by not getting a diploma, you have the knowledge, the working knowledge. You'll go back to Eretz Yisrael and function on the farm. And the baron will have gotten his investment paid back. Okay. So he goes to France. He comes back to Israel. He goes to Metula, okay, by the border. And there's a new settlement under the auspices of Baron Rothschild. And the problem is that Aaron Aronson complains to Rothschild, your overseers are stealing everything. You promised me we were going to have X equipment and that number of people and this kind of seed and crops. This is all going to work out fine if the material was there. But what happened? The overseers just pocketed the money. You're being robbed. He sends this to Paris in the mail. And the baron doesn't want to hear about it. Oh, who do you think you are, you little whippersnapper? I'm not asking you how to run my ship. So it wasn't, it was totally truthful. The baron was being robbed. In the long history of the yeshuv, it's a known thing that in the first Aliyah, the overseers who worked for Rothschild and were on the ground in Eretz Yisrael were dictators and tyrants. And they were nasty to the early Olim, and a lot of them stole. Okay, so he quits his job. He has many different offers. He's working in the agricultural industry in various places in the first few years of the 20th century. In 1906, he becomes world famous, Aaron Aronson, for discovering what? Emmer, the mother of wheat, the mother of all wheat. That for 50 years, agronomists had been looking for the original species of wheat on the premise that if you found it and that it was going to be somewhere in the Middle East, you could hybridize it and make some more hardier crop that would feed more people and avert starvation around the world. It didn't actually work out that way, but the discovery itself was a major discovery. He found it on the back side of Mount Hermon, on the wrong side, not the ski slope side, but the other side, the Syrian side of Mount Hermon. And that made him world famous. Aside from the fact that he found it, he was also a very smart man. He spoke seven languages, and he was an expert in all matters of Eretz Yisrael, the soil, the flowers, the crops. Okay. But Aronson understood something very important, that the solution to Israel's problems lay somewhere else in the world, on the far side of the world, in California. That California was the answer to all of Israel's problems. Why?
Same kind of soil.
Same climate. Good. So Berkeley, California invited him to give a couple of drushes. And he wowed the crowd. And they offered him a professorship at Berkeley. But he declined it in 1909. He took a long trip to America. He declined the professorship because he wanted to live his life as a Jew in Eretz Israel. That was more important to him. But he was making contacts all over America. And in 1910, he cut a deal with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to establish the Jewish Agricultural Experiment Station in the Land of Israel that would be paid for in part by U.S. tax dollars and would be officially registered as an American institution abroad. And the land was going to be supplied by JNF. And he would conduct scientific experiments, agricultural experiments, in this station. Where did he pick? The land was Atlit. So where's Atlit? It's northwest of Zichron Yaakov and just south of Haifa. Why there? It's near his home. And also, for espionage purposes, near the coast, as we'll see soon enough. Okay. So this station... What was that?
That's where they brought in the Jews after the war.
Right. Yeah. At Atlit, yeah. So...
Was he married then?
No, he never married. He was kind of in love with... A woman who married somebody else and they maintained a platonic relationship even afterwards. We'll discuss the issues of marriage in this family. None of the marriages worked out in this Aronson family. They were all, well, except for Ephraim Fishel and Malka, the parents, but otherwise the kids had problems in the romantic life. So the station was functioning for 4 years, between 1911 and 1914. But Aronson got into trouble. Got into big trouble with the local population. What sin against Zionism did Aronson commit?
He hired Arab workers.
Bingo! He hired Arab workers. He violated the rule of Avodah Ivrit. Why did he hire Arab workers? So I'll give you a few different answers, but you have to understand each one is complementary. The first is that he was a first Aliyah guy, not a second Aliyah guy. He was a child of the first Aliyah. They, in their own time, in the 1880s and 90s, were hiring Arab labor. This was not a verboten thing. It became that way in the second Aliyah with the socialists who wanted to rebuild Israel in their own image and ignore the existence of the Arab population. So that's one difference between him and the socialists who arrived after him. The other is that he firmly believed you needed Arab labor, specifically Arab labor, because Westerners don't know the tricks of the trade in the Middle East. You have to look at the ancient techniques of the Arab laborer on the farm to know what, to figure out what they know that you don't know. Then you combine your scientific know-how and mechanical ability to produce the machinery with what they taught you. So the metal plow somehow didn't work very well. The wooden plow worked better. But only the Arabs knew that. And then he learned that from the Arabs. So it was this idea is you have to glean knowledge from the indigenous inhabitants that otherwise we'll never have. Okay. So That's one problem, one aveira, Arab labor. The other is, he didn't cater to the interests of the local population in Zichron Yaakov. There was a very famous doctor, Dr. Hillel Yaffe, who was one of the leaders in the fight against malaria in pre-state Israel. And he thought that the medical office at this station was going to be under his auspices, and they hired somebody else. Why? Because for good reasons, that there were diseases that Yaffe didn't know about. He wanted to hire someone else. So he was making enemies here and there among the local population, even before the war started. Then, when the war begins, Aronson is put to work by the Ottoman government to prevent or to minimize the devastation wrought by a locust plague. Right out of the Bible, a locust plague hit Israel in 1915. And given that the crops had already been requisitioned for military purposes and now the locusts were eating everything, it's going to ruin the countryside, the yeshuv, and even plenty of the Arab population was going to suffer inordinately. Something has to be done. So Aronson and his team of experts were going around the country trying to fight off the locust plague. And they did a good job of it in 1915. But being a government employee, so to speak, and going all over the country meant that he could do what? Reconnaissance. He could see everything that otherwise wouldn't be seen. Military bases, troop movements, weaponry. He knew it all. He knew the country better than anyone else, including all the secret locations, secret military locations. Around the same time, his sister Sarah comes back from Constantinople. And in 1915, they make a pact, a pledge, that they're going to create a spy ring and spy for the British against the Ottomans. Sarah Aronson, on her way home from Constantinople, saw a massacre of Armenians with her own eyes. And that transformed her thinking on the subject and said, we have to fight these people, they're the devil, and we have to get them out of the country if we want to have a Jewish Israel.
Why was she in Constantinople?
Okay, so why was she in Constantinople? Now we get to the romance. So Sarah was the older sister. Rivka was the younger sister. All right, and what do we know from Lavan?
You don't marry.
You know, the younger one doesn't get married first. So the problem was that their good buddy was Avshalom Feinberg. Avshalom Feinberg was one of the co-founders of Neeli, of the spy ring. He was from Chadera and also from the old families of the first Aliyah. He and Rivka fell in love and they were engaged. But they couldn't get married unless Sarah got married first. So what happened? Aaron arranged for a marriage between Sarah and a friend of his, Chaim Avraham, who lived in Constantinople and was some kind of businessman. He was an Israeli Jew who was off in Turkey on business, who was 40 years old, 17 years older than Sarah, and they didn't especially like each other. So it was a bogus marriage. It was never consummated, they say. But she went off to live there so that Rivka could marry Avshalom. The trouble is that in the end, Avshalom gets killed, and Rivka doesn't marry him, and Sarah gets killed, and the marriage with Mr. Avraham was a bogus, and Sarah fell in love with Menachem Mendel Schneerson, and it was a whole problem. I'll get to the issue of Schneerson in a second. Not the Rebbe, but Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Okay. No, as far as we know, not related. Okay. So they decide we're going to establish this spy ring. The problem is, how do you contact the British? How do you get a hold of the British? You can't go to England, because England is the enemy, and these are all Ottoman citizens, because they've been in the country for a while. They're not right off the boat. So Aaron has an idea. We're going to send Avshalom Feinberg to Egypt with a fake passport, a fake Spanish passport. All right? He's going to grow a beard, look a little different. We're going to send him off to Egypt. So he goes there in late 1915. And he's successful in reaching Egypt. And he meets Leonard Woolley. Leonard Woolley was something of a famous archaeologist, a British professorial type, who was in the military in Egypt at the time. And they hatch a plan that Feinberg is going to go home and About a month later, there'll be a British warship, a small little ship. It's going to come off the coast of Palestine near Atlit, near Zichron Yaakov, and they're going to do an exchange, or they're going to flash signals in Morse code. Something's going to happen. A contact will be made. So Feinberg gets on a boat and goes home. Goes back to Eretz Yisrael via Cyprus, I think. Not Cyprus, Crete.
So where was he?
He was in Alexandria, in Alexandria. Problem is, there never was a boat, and there never was any contact. What happened was Woolley didn't speak to his superiors about this possible spy ring. Then he went into battle and got captured and was taken prisoner of war and rode out the war in Damascus in a jail. So nobody in the British hierarchy knew anything about the Israeli Jews who want to spy for them. So it was a successful mission, but then no follow-up. So time is passing. It's now the middle of 1916, and a British invasion of Eretz Yisrael has not happened yet, but the thinking is that it should happen. So now let's pause for a moment and not talk about how Aaron makes his way to Egypt. Instead, talk about British war policy. So there were two schools of thought among the British. There were the Easterners and the Westerners. The Easterners believed that the war in Europe is the central war here. It's not really a world war. It's a European war in the trenches between France and Germany. But in order to win the Western War, the European War, we need to force the Germans to withdraw a goodly number of their soldiers to an Eastern front and get them bogged down there so as to make victory possible in the West. Now, how did the British attempt to do this? At the Battle of Gallipoli, which was a disaster. Okay, the Battle of Gallipoli cost hundreds of thousands of men. The best of the British army died at Gallipoli with Winston Churchill. Okay, it was a big disaster. Why? They tried a seaborne invasion of the Hellespont, and it didn't work out. So, Yesh Omrim in the British army, we tried the Eastern approach, and it failed. So let's not try it again. Let's just be Westerners. We'll focus on the European war and don't involve me with anything going on further to the east. The Ottomans, let them worry about themselves. That was the Western approach. But the Eastern approach said, no. We tried once and we failed. We'll try again at a different spot, somewhere else in the Ottoman realm. So Aaronson, who wants to get the British to invade Eretz Israel for the purposes of Zionism and Jewish nationalism, he believes that what should happen is the British should invade Palestine from the coast, or even Lebanon from the coast, and then come down and get the Turkish army from behind. The Turkish army was stationed at Gaza. Well, the reason Aaronson believed that would be a good strategy is because he knew from his reconnaissance that there were only about 20 patrol stations along the whole Palestinian coast, each one with about 10 men. So it would be a cakewalk if you actually landed a significant army, you'd waltz on it and take over Eretz Israel. The British didn't know that. He wants to tell them that. Of course, the question will be, do they believe him? Is he a reliable source of information? So in a second, we'll get to that. But even before he gets there, another wrinkle to the British theory, they tried an invasion from the sea at Gallipoli. If they're going to try another eastern venture, maybe it shouldn't be from the sea, it should be overland, which means going from Egypt through the Sinai up into Israel. It's not going to be an easy sell to say, try again in the east and try again from the sea, as opposed to overland. That's going to be a problem that Aaronson will face. Okay. So, in June of 1916, Aaronson decides, you know what? Before he goes, Feinberg, who had gone and made contact with the British in October, November of 1915, when he saw that the British were not following through, he wanted to go back to Egypt. And this time he figured, I'll go overland through the Sinai. I'll hire a Bedouin, a camel, a mule, whatever it is. We'll go in the desert and we'll make our way to Egypt. The trouble is, it's an illegal crossing. He gets to the edge of Ottoman Palestine. There's a no-man's land, and then you have the British region in Egypt, and you have Bedouins who are hostile and want to shoot everyone. So he gets arrested at the border, the no man's land, and he gets put in jail. Fortunately for Feinberg, he had a friend, Yosef Leshansky, who was the leader of Hamagen. Now, Hamagen was like Hashomer. Hashomer was a self-defense brigade with security guards. Hamagen was a security guard group in the southern part of the country that didn't get along with Hashomer so well. So Leshansky bribes a prison official and gets Feinberg out of jail. And Feinberg eventually is able to go back to Zichron Yaakov and rejoin his collaborators in Nili, in Netzach Yisrael Yishaker, the spy ring. So Aaronson now wants to go to Egypt. How's he going to get there? Not overland. He's going to have to go by boat. But he can't wear a beard and have a fake passport because he's a VIP. People know who he is. How's he going to get out of the country and go to the enemy terrain? The answer is go through a neutral country. Neutral country. So he goes to Constantinople, takes him 3 weeks to get there. In Constantinople, he asks for permission to go to Germany to study with the great German scientists, the great botanists and agronomists. In particular, Otto Warburg, who was the president of the Zionist organization, who was a famous botanist. And he gets permission from the Turkish to go to Germany. Okay, it's an allied country, fine. You want to go to Germany, go to Germany. Then once in Germany, he then applies in the consulate for permission to go to neutral countries of Denmark and Sweden. Why? Because there are famous professors in Denmark and Sweden who have information that I need for my scientific research. Somehow he finagles a visa to go to Denmark and Sweden from Copenhagen. Then, as a neutral country, he wants to go to America, another neutral country in 1916. You know, Wilson kept us out of war. Okay. Well, he had some money in his pocket. And plus, the Americans were paying him a little bit. So he wants to go to America, another neutral country. And he gets permission to go to America. But the problem is, and it turns out it's not a problem at all, it's to his advantage. If you want to go from Denmark to America in 1916, you have to stop. Where? England, Scotland. And when they stop in Scotland, so citizens of hostile nations could potentially be arrested. Not necessarily, they might be allowed to pass through as, you know, civilians and go on to America, but they run the risk of being arrested. Well, Aaronson wanted to be arrested. That was the whole point. Because the Turkish will know that he never made it to America. If he's not arrested, it'll make it seem as though he did this all as a bluff, it was all a scam. If he gets arrested, it looks like it was no choice of his own. He was just captured by the other team. So he gets himself arrested, and then reveals his identity, that he wants to function as a spy. He goes to London. It takes a few weeks for them to believe his story, because no one is 100% sure that he's not a Turkish spy, because maybe he's just trying to get their secrets and reveal it to, you know, handlers back home. But they believe him. They take a sporting chance, as the British would say, a sporting chance, that Aaronson is the real deal. And he goes to Egypt. He goes to Alexandria, then to Cairo. In Cairo,
Egypt is
nominally Ottoman territory, but in fact, since the 1880s, has been a British protectorate. So the British army is stationed in Egypt. Okay. So it took him from June until November to get to Egypt. It took 5 months, basically, to do what he wanted to do. Once he's there, he's supplying relevant information to the British authorities. And they're listening to it and agreeing with most of it. The person who he encounters who is most supportive is Mark Sykes. Now, that name should ring something of a bell to you. Sykes-Picot Agreement. So Mark Sykes was a British diplomat, an adventurer and soldier, who in 1915 cut a deal with the French about the division of the Ottoman Empire should the empire fall to the other team, and they're going to divide it up based upon spheres of influence, with the French getting further to the north and the British getting further to the south. However, that was before Mark Sykes converted to Zionism. He was a bit of an anti-Semite. And what is a British anti-Semite? Someone who hates Jews more than they have to. Right. So he was really not a Jew hater, but he was an anti-Semite in like the traditional British sense until he met Aaronson. Then he became an avowed Zionist and walked back to the Sykes-Picot Agreement that had his name on it and became a real supporter of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So one of the things that Aaronson was able to do for the British while he was there early on was explain to them, you are doing the wrong thing when it comes to water. You think that when you invade, you're going to have to pipe water from Cairo or from the Nile up through the Sinai to wherever your forces are, and it's going to be a real problem in terms of material and laying on the ground and the resources. Rubbish. You don't need to do that. He explained to them, the water is under the ground. That here it's 20 feet under, here it's 40 feet under, here it's 50 feet under, you just have to drill. Because he knew from his geological studies how far down was the water table in any given area. And they listened to him, they did it, and they found he was correct. In one case, he said he quoted, how do I know this is true? Because Josephus said that there were gardens in a certain part of Israel where today it appears to be desert. If there were gardens in the days of Josephus, there had to have been water. Where was the water? Below the ground. He had all sorts of chachmas about water. Okay, but what he wants more than anything is to maintain contact with his people back in Eretz Yisrael. And so he's pushing them, let's go on a boat to the coast off of Atlit, where my people every single night are going and waiting for us to make contact with them. That when I left, I told them, I'll be back in 2-3 months, and I'm going to come back by boat with the British. And we're going to do the wave of the signals, and someone's going to swim out and get the packages. So they're waiting every single night for us to be there. Okay, so they get a boat. The Managem, some sort of small boat, didn't fit too many people, but a British Army boat. And they go, December 29th, 1916. They get to about 2 kilometers off the coast of Eretz Yisrael. And then the boat can't go any further because it's a rocky area. You have to have a rowboat that goes closer. And then even the rowboat can't go all the way. Someone has to swim the last 100 yards. Okay? So they get as close as they can get, and the captain of the ship says, the seas are too rough. We can't land. Go back. When can you go again? The next time there's dark skies, no moon. So by Rosh Chodesh time they have to go. So they go again in January. Again, the seas are too rough. So it's not going to be until February of 1917, which is a good 9 months after Aaronson left Israel, that he'll finally be able to make contact with his family back home. But in the meantime, something else happened. You know, because he was taking too long, the guys back in Zichron Yaakov are wondering, where is he? You know, why doesn't he come back? So Avshalom Feinberg decides, with Yosef Leshansky, we're going to go overland to Egypt. We're going to try. You know, he tried the year before, he got arrested. We're going to try again. So they try. They get to the no man's land. And instead of getting arrested by Ottoman officers, they just get attacked by a Bedouin. And Feinberg is shot and killed. And Leshansky is shot and injured. But a friendly Bedouin, a good Samaritan, a good Bedouin, decide to help him onto a mule and take him to Cairo. So Leshansky makes it to Cairo and meets Aaron Aaronson and says, I'm sorry to tell you, buddy, but Avshalom Feinberg is dead. But I'm here, and we've been waiting for you all this time. How come you haven't shown up? And he explains to him, well, with the boat, the seas were too rough. You know, it took me forever to get here, but we're going to try again next month. So finally, in February of 1917, Leshansky goes on the boat and makes it and swims across the water and makes it back to Atlit. And there's an exchange of information. Intelligence gathering, which had been done all throughout the previous year, was handed off to the British, and they're very happy to receive it. Why didn't Aaron Aaronson get off the boat and go back to Israel? Why not? The British wouldn't let him. The British would not let him get off the boat to go back to Israel. Why not? Because, number one, there's a trust factor. They're not 100% sure they can trust him. But even if they can trust him, they don't want to lose him. He's too valuable to, while he's with them, as opposed to running the risk of him going back into Israel and having to try to come back and being unsuccessful. So they'd rather have his messenger boys, his underlings, do the dangerous work of getting on and off the boat and being exposed to the Ottoman authorities, and Aronson himself always being under a British protection. So he never, so long as the war was ongoing, went back to Israel. He would go back to Israel briefly after the British conquest. Okay. Who's running the spy operation while he's away? His sister Sarah. So Sarah's running the show with Leshansky as the number two. So, how did they go about collecting information? They had about 30 to 40 people who worked for them full-time as spies. But these were not people who, if you ask them what they do for a living, they say, I'm a spy. They had a job, and the job that they did, it was a legitimate job, but it allowed them to collect information. For example, the military doctors in the Ottoman army were Jews of the Yishuv. And the Ottoman army was very careful to make sure they checked all of their soldiers, even the lower-ranking soldiers, for various diseases. They had a checkup every year. And so this doctor knew all the diseases and all the problems of the lower-ranking soldiers and the high-ranking soldiers. Also, they set up, in classic Jewish fashion, to run a general store or a commissary right outside the military bases. You know, to buy the Gatorade and the Powerade and the peanut bags of peanuts. So the Jews ran these stores in the Negev and near Beersheba by all the the Turkish military bases. And people talk, you know, over a cup of coffee, they talk. So by this means, plus there was another locust outbreak. And again, who was fighting the locusts? The Neeli people. From all these various means, they knew everything that was going on in the country. Everything. And passed it all along to the British. So, very good information. Yeah?
Was the Arab population in Palestine siding with the Ottomans?
So, the Arab population of Arabia was supposed to be incited against the Ottomans in order to achieve some kind of independence under British protection, you know, Lawrence of Arabia. But the Lawrence of Arabia story is a big myth. It never really happened. I mean, yes, there were certain battles in the Hejaz, and the Arabs eventually do fight a few skirmishes. But for the most part, the big Arab revolt that the British were supposed to foment to help them secure defeat of the Ottomans never really came to pass. The Jews did more through Aronson's Neeli than the Arabs ever did. The Arabs of Eretz Yisrael are kind of indifferent. They don't really care. Some of them are conscripted into the army, but they're not avowed Ottomans, they're just local Arabs who don't have much of an agenda other than they're not so happy with the Jews.
They didn't feel a kinship.
No. So, it's early 1917, and the British are going to go to war in Eretz Yisrael. And Aronson's telling them, go from the coast, you'll win. And they say, no, we're going to go overland. So they go to Gaza, March 27th. What happens? Disaster! The Ottomans win. The British are terribly defeated. Worse yet, now the Turks are angry. And they're angry at the Jews because they think the Jews are siding with the British. They don't have any evidence yet of a spy ring. That hasn't been busted yet. That'll happen 6 months later.
Why do they think that?
Well, it was pretty apparent that the Jews don't have any love for Turkish authority in the country, and that they would do better under British suzerainty. So the Turks decide to expel the Jews of Tel Aviv and Yafo. Expel them. To where? Inland. They got to go to Petah Tikva, they got to go to Yerushalayim, they got to go wherever they can go, to Rishon Lezion, and they're not allowed to go to Haifa. That's another thing. It was off limits. So this is 10,000 Jews being expelled from their homes Pesach week. Pesach week. It's a humanitarian crisis. The leader of Jamal Pasha of the Turks, he thought he would get away with this without anybody knowing what happened. Why? Because it's 1917, not 2017, and there's no internet. So how is anyone going to know in the West that he committed some kind of a war crime against the Jewish population? Nobody's going to know. Well, guess what? Everybody knew right away because Neeli was sending information back to Egypt and to the British authorities. And so now it became a public thing, an international scandal, that the Turkish, they kicked the Jews out of their homes in Pesach week. And 10,000 people are starving, living out under the stars. Okay. Well,
excuse me.
Yeah. Every month there was a boat that went back and forth from Atlit to Port Said in Egypt. So the boat first came in February, came again in March, came again in April, in June, in August, and in September. There were, I think, six occasions when the boat made transfers of information. And by the way, the British and the Jews in Egypt were sending care packages back home to Eretz Israel. And the guys at Atlit said, stop sending this because it goes in the water for the last 100 yards. And the chocolates and the flowers and this and that are all getting gemished. And you can't use it. It's useless. So don't bother sending these goodie packages. We'll just send you the information and that's the end of it. Okay. So the Jews have a problem. They need to feed their people. They need humanitarian assistance. Where's the money going to come from? Where's the money going to come from? So American philanthropists, you know, the usual suspects, Louis Marshall, Jacob Schiff, Felix Warburg, the heavy hitters of American Judaism, and the Zionists in particular, like Louis Brandeis, are going to facilitate the transfer of money to Eretz Yisrael. But it's, of course, illegal. So the Neely guys from the boat have to carry a sack full of 300 pounds of gold coins. Now, the question is, can you trust someone with a bag of gold coins? Are there people who are in this for material gain, or is this all the shame of Shemayim? So one of the things about Neely was it was never for material gain. It was always for the right reasons, the shame of Shemayim, for the sake of heaven, for the sake of the Jewish people. Yeah?
This monetary thing, was this before or after April 17th?
So the money comes after April 17th.
You're sending money to
an enemy country. Enemy country. From an American point of view, it was a problem. It had to be kept really secret. Okay. The problem, of course, is that if Neely is doing the transfer, but the Aronson family is not well-liked in the country, there will be accusations that they misappropriated some money. You know, from the Daf Yomi crowd, they were guilty of Me'ila, so to speak. They were not liked in the country because of Bregis. They hired Arab labor. They didn't hire the right people. They were not married to the right family. They're endangering the public by engaging in espionage. Okay, that's another important thing. Jews don't like spies. V'lamal shinim al tehi tikva. You know? If you're a moiser, you go to Gehenim. Okay, so for 1,800 years, the Jews didn't have an army. If you don't have an army, what kind of spying do you do? Really, the only one who's guilty of espionage is someone who's working against the community. And we don't like such people. It's only with the establishment of the Haganah in the 1920s, and then the State of Israel, the IDF in 1948, that the notion of spying has some respectability. But in 1917, for the mainstream leadership of the Yishuv, for Jews to engage in spycraft, it's pasnish, it's a shanda. So that's why guys like Mayor Dizengoff, okay, the first mayor of Tel Aviv, one of the leading members of the Yishuv, he didn't like Neely. He didn't like Aronson. And did whatever he could to undermine Neely all along the way. So when the money came from overseas, there were accusations, you pocketed it for yourself. You didn't give it to the right people. Machlokis over what to do with the money. And all this was just to feed people who were starving. All right. Well, the battle for Gaza continues. The second battle for Gaza was in late April. And again, abysmal failure. So the British didn't learn their lesson. They tried the same thing twice and had the same result twice. So now Aronson says, listen, I understand you're not going to go on a coastal route. Fine. But don't be a fool and try to attack Gaza a third time. Go around and go to Beersheba because they're not expecting it. So you do a feint towards Gaza, just to draw them off guard, and then you go around with a major force and take Beersheba, and then come around and kill everybody from behind. Ultimately, that's what happens. The Aronson advice is listened to, and later in the year, in October, there will be a great victory. which will lead to the conquest of Jerusalem by December 9th, 1917. In the summer of 1917, the British Army thought they wouldn't be in Jerusalem until a year from then, middle of 1918, and it would cost 40,000 lives. In reality, it was 5 months later they were in Jerusalem, and it cost only a few thousand lives. So Aronson is credited by Winston Churchill with hastening the end of the war and saving tens of thousands of British soldiers. That's what Winston Churchill credited Aaron Aronson with. And it's the case. He gave them good Eitz HaTovah. All right. But that's all into the future, October of 17. We've got to go to September of 17, when disaster strikes. So two things went wrong. The first thing is, they wanted to have more regular communication between Cairo and Zichron Yaakov. Okay, so they thought of a few ideas. One was wireless communication. What kind of wireless communication existed in 1917?
Morse code?
So Morse code, flashing signals, I guess, but that didn't work out well because it would be too easily caught. It would be too easily detected by people who they didn't want to have notice anything was going on. Wired communication was a possibility, but it's too long of a distance, and where are you going to lay the cable? It's going to get seen. No good.
Like the Indians,
you
have fires.
That's Rosh symbols was fires in the old days. Okay. Another option is to have people go through the desert, but that also isn't such a good idea because, I mean, Feinberg got killed that way. So the only option was pigeons, carrier pigeons. So they tried 7 carrier pigeons out of Cairo to send it to Zichron Yaakov. 3 of them made it, but the others didn't. And of those that didn't, one of them landed on the property of a Turkish officer, and he saw there was an encrypted message attached to the foot of the bird. So it took him a week to figure out what the code was. It was a combination of Hebrew, Yiddish, and Arabic. But somehow they figured it out, and they knew there was a spy ring, and they had some information. Simultaneous with that, a person got caught. Naaman Belkind was the head of Neely in the south. And he wasn't told the truth about what happened to Feinberg. All he knew was Feinberg went into the desert and never came back. And he says, I'm going to go find him. And he tries to go overland. And he gets caught. And not only does he get caught and arrested, he was wearing documents sewed into his vest. And so now they know there's a spy ring. They're from two different sources, from the bird and from Belkind. So he's arrested and tortured. And under torture, he probably revealed information. We don't know exactly what he revealed, but now the Ottomans know that there is a Jewish spy ring based out of Zichron Yaakov, and based out of the Aronson family that was running the agricultural station at Atlit. So on September 30th, there was Sukkot. The Turks decide to make their move. At dawn the next day, they're going to come on to Zichron Yaakov from all four sides, October 1st. And the family was in Zichron Yaakov because they were observing Yontif. They weren't at Atlit. Everybody's going to get arrested. It's not going to be good. In truth, they knew something was up already about a week earlier. And the boat was coming on September 23rd. And Aronson had said, let's get everybody back to Cairo. Evacuate all of our people. We could have 60 people on the boat. The captain of the ship says we could have 60 people. Let's take everybody off and go to Cairo for safety. Sarah said, not yet. Why? Because Leshansky had the fever. He had 105 fever and couldn't be moved. He was near death. All right. So come back in 2 days, the 25th. Again, there was a delay. Come the 27th. They said, we can't come the 27th because the moon is already too bright. We'd have to wait a whole another month. And so Sarah made a blunder and didn't go on the 25th. And there was no boat coming back on the 27th. Leshansky got better. He had a fever. He calmed down. But because they didn't go on the boat, only two people, a sister-in-law and a nephew, a young nephew, they went to safety. Everybody else stayed on land. And on October 1st, the town is invaded. Everybody's arrested. Sarah is tortured. And she reveals nothing under torture. Her father is tortured, and there was rumors that he died. He was 69 years old. Those rumors were false. He lived. He lived another 22 years. He died at the age of 91. Lived a very long life. Ephraim Fishel Aronson. He outlived most of his kids. Okay? So they're tortured, and on October 5th, there's a decision made. We're going to transfer everybody to Nazareth, to a different prison. Sarah says, can I go home to change my clothes? And they say, fine, go home and change your clothes. When she goes home, she locks the door, she writes a goodbye letter, and she shoots herself in the mouth. But she doesn't die. So for 4 days, she lives, and she's requesting from Dr. Yaffe that he put her out of her misery, but he refuses. He gives her morphine. On October 9th, she dies. They have a burial for her, a funeral, and you can see it. I think on the internet, you can find the picture of her grave. There's a fence around her grave because she committed suicide. They didn't want to bury her in the cemetery because you're not allowed to bury a person who commits suicide. So her and her mother are in this fenced off area in the larger cemetery of Zichron Yaakov. They go to Nazareth. And they go to Damascus. In Damascus, more people are tortured, trying to extract more information, but people aren't really talking. Naaman Belkind, who was originally arrested down south, he is sentenced to death, but they don't carry it out yet because they're on the lookout for Leshansky, for Yosef Leshansky. He is on the run, and they can't find him. He's hiding, he's dressing up as a Bedouin. Then Hashomer finds him. Remember what I said about Hashomer? They didn't get along with Neely. They shoot him. They try to kill their own guy, but they failed. They botched the assassination. He lived. He was hit in the shoulder, so he was on the run another week. Finally, he gets caught again, and he gets arrested and sent to Damascus. On December 15th, Belkind and Leshansky are executed in Damascus. Aaron Aronson, doesn't know about any of this because he's not in the country. And the boat's not going back and forth. He finds out about Sarah's death while he's on a boat to America sometime later. Now, what happened to Aaron? Aaron himself goes to London in September of 1917. Why does he go to London? Because the Zionist leadership, Weizmann and the other cabal, are giving him problems over the distribution of the charitable monies. To the relief monies. Plus, Aronson wants to be in London because that's where the action is. So as it turned out, three leading Zionists were in London simultaneously. Weizmann was working the diplomatic angle, Jabotinsky was working the military angle, and Aronson was working the spy angle. And they're all roughly around the same age. Weizmann was born in 1874, Aronson 1876, Jabotinsky 1880. They're all pro-British, and think that the British victory in Israel will lead to the flowering of Zionism. Each one pursuing things from a different perspective. Okay. But they never fully accept Aronson into the leadership elite of British Zionism. They send him to America on a speaking tour to talk to Brandeis and to the others to try to raise some money because they know he has contacts in America. The American government likes him. It was on the way to America that he found out what happened back home, that everybody got killed. Okay. He comes back to England, and then he goes to Israel, 1918, the summer of 18. In the summer of 18, what was happening in Israel? So the southern part of the country was already taken over by the British, but the northern part of the country was still in Ottoman hands. And they asked him, would you run another spy ring to help conquer the northern part of the country? And he thought about it. In the end, nothing happened. There was no resurrection of Neely for another go-around. Okay. So the war is over. And he goes to London. Why? To participate in the Paris Peace Conference. Because they want him there, since he knows Eretz Yisrael better than anybody else, the Weizmanns of the world need him on the scene as an expert advisor. And he's going back and forth between Paris and London. And how does he go? By plane. And his sister told him, the sister Rivka told him, don't take the plane, take the boat. You know, planes are dangerous. And on one of the missions, on May 15th, 1919, crashed. He died. Interestingly, who else had a near-fatal crash a day later? Lawrence of Arabia. But he lived outside of Rome. So some say that there was foul play here in both of those plane crashes, that there were enemies of Aronson and enemies of Lawrence who wanted them both dead. There's no evidence of this, but there's a little bit of funny business. If you read on some of the articles on the conspiracy sites, you can see what happened to Aaron Aronson, what really happened. Okay. Now, in the minute we have left, what happened to Neely? It's, you know, a posthumous legacy. Were people proud of it, angry with them? So the answer is that Neely was not given much credit, or the credit it was due, during the period of the Yishuv and the early period of the state. Why? Well, they had enemies at the time who continued to live for the next few decades, and the state leadership was in the hands of people who were part of the Hashomer. One of the founders of Hashomer, one of the early members, not the founders, but one of the early members, was Levi Eshkol. Okay, so long as the Labor Party was in control of the mechanisms of the state, you weren't going to have cities named after postage stamps named after Aronson. Huh?
Or a movie,
right. In 1967, an adventurer decided, I'm going to find the grave of Avshalom Feinberg somewhere in the desert. And it was over the border, so after the Six-Day War, it was possible to go looking. And they bribed some Bedouin who said, oh, there's the Jew's grave. It was known, the Jew's grave. And there was a date palm, a tree growing from the ground in a random spot in the desert. What happened? Feinberg took some food with him for the road, took some dates. When he was shot, the Bedouins rummaged through his clothes. They found the dates. They ate the dates. They put those pits in his grave. And from those pits grew a tree. And that's how they were able to find his grave. They exhumed the body. It was found to be Feinberg. They checked the dental records. Okay, and so he was buried on Har Herzl. But still, the government was not so fond of Neely. In 1978, who's the prime minister? Menachem Begin. Then Yosef Leshansky's body was disinterred from where it had been first and put on Har Herzl next to Avshalom Feinberg. They could die and rest in peace together. After him having been accused of killing his friend, it was all lies and propaganda put out by the left, so they could rest in peace together on Har Herzl. And why does Begin do this? Because Begin regarded the Irgun and the Chayrut as the logical successor to Neely. And there's a strong case to be made for that. So that's why you don't have the kind of, you don't have the stamps, the cities, the textbooks, all the stuff you'd expect about heroes of Israel. You're not going to find it pre-1977. And even post-1977, there's not that much of it. You go to Beit Aronson and Zichron Yaakov, that's where you have the museum. But other than that, they haven't been given the kind of glory in death that they might have deserved. So now, but not at an earlier time, because the memory has evolved, and so they are now considered in the pantheon of heroes, whereas in the beginning they were seen as scoundrels. Yeah.
I think there's a video from 2 years ago, the 100th recreation of the Battle of Beersheba.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think you can find it on YouTube.
Oh, I'll take a look.
All right.